At a certain level, computers are all about giving computational power and resources to the common man. Even though many of you may not remember, it wasn't that long ago when computers were tools that could only be afforded by very largest of companies. Today, however, computers are a common fixture of our everyday lives. We can look towards companies like Apple, IBM, and Microsoft, as well as Cisco, Sun, Novell, and countless others, as being the driving forces behind making computers small, powerful, and more importantly, cheap enough to work their way into common usage. Power to and for the people. However, when you look at the big computing companies and the executives who drive their success, it may be hard to feel a connection, a familiarity, or a friend in those faces. They are big individuals making big decisions and driving big industry in ways that are hard for you to relate to. There are some computing executives, however, who break that mold and feel, well, like us. You can see in their faces their roots as an ordinary person, as a common man. Here at Microsoft, one of those executives is Scott Guthrie. Hello, I'm Robert Hess, and I'll be your host today as we talk with Scott Guthrie, Corporate Vice President of the Azure Application Platform team. I hope you enjoy this opportunity to look at the technology and the person behind the code. In the last 15 years at Microsoft, Scott Guthrie has been a constant force in the ever-evolving .NET platform. After starting out in the Internet Information Server Group in 1997, he soon began the initial work on what would eventually turn into ASP.NET and one of the core pillars of the overall .NET framework. He has since become a fixture, if not a figurehead, of the .NET development worldwide. His straightforward nature and ability to still spend time deep in code reminds developers that he is one of us. When we see Scott on stage showing us the upcoming features of a technology he's working on, we see ourselves. We see our future. Join me now as I welcome today's guest, Scott Guthrie.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. My God, you know, like you are the face of .NET programming. And that red shirt of yours, too. Yeah. So, I mean, where did it all begin from? I mean, you know, where did you first pick up your technology roots?
I've always been, since kind of the very beginning, interested in technologies. My parents were in the technology business, and so, you know, we basically had a computer in the house from at least the point where I was like one or something. And
now you really make me feel old.
Well, I don't think it was a computer in the modern sense. It was I think some kind of teletype, you know, connected to 3270 okay. or something.
I feel better now.
Yeah, you know, Series 60 or whatever the heck it was way back when. It's something I've kind of grown up with.
Did you do much programming back then at all, or just playing Hunt the Wumpus or whatever?
When I was one, not much programming. But I started programming probably, probably 7 or 8. There was some like code camp or programming camp or something I remember going off to, and I was probably, maybe it was 8 or 9. And, it was one of those 2-week-long camps, learn basic programming on a, you know, original Apple II, and the ones that didn't have the shift key, so you couldn't do uppercase. and it's kind of been ever since then.
Yeah. And did your parents kind of push you that direction, or did you go after it on your own?
No, they never really pushed me in it. And so my parents were always, hey, find something you're passionate around and, you know, go for it. And so I was pretty convinced I was not going to do computer science or go get in the programming business, probably because my parents had been. And so
And you're trying to rebel against your parents a bit?
No, it always was something that, for me, I liked, but it felt really easy. And I wanted to do something kind of different and out there and stuff. And so I actually was going to, even until like kind of my junior year of college, was probably going to go down, get a PhD in history or something and teach history
something
or
something. Something really useful like that.
Yeah, something, contribute back to society or something. And so it was actually relatively late that, you know, I realized I might be a decent history professor, but maybe I could do something better as a programmer in the world.
.NET was waiting for you, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or, you know, at the very least, I might write some more interesting stuff that way. So, and thankfully I'd taken enough computer science classes, and I was actually a TA of computer science.
Oh.
So it was actually pretty easy for me to get my major in computer science, and the rest was history.
Kind of switch it across.
Yeah. I actually did an internet startup in college. And
Really?
Yeah. It was kind of early days of the internet. You know, so it was like when we went to the at sign and emails, kind of that early. And
I'm sure like 92, 3, 4, 5?
Yeah, kind of 92, 93. And, you know, back then most companies were not connected at all to the internet. And so I was part of a company, and we had sort of internet or email relay systems. And so we'd actually, were selling those for mostly corporate internal purposes. And then we realized, like, hey, you know what? You could actually connect them over dial-up, and we could kind of adapt it so that we could actually support, like, thousands of companies. And so we ended up having gateways that companies could set it up, so every 30 minutes they'd dial up, upload email, download email, and basically put companies on the internet. And then we sort of said, oh, there's this thing called the web, and, you know, HTML, and you know, these were early days. I think we were running, you know, the Mosaic server or something. And,
yeah.
You know, it was kind of, you could get a company on the present, but it was mostly email. And, you know, we had a nice turnkey package, and we could pitch a customer and say, look, you got 1,000, you know, people inside your organization that already have email. Doesn't matter what email system it is. We'll get you on the internet, get you a nice domain name, give you email routing and stuff. And kind of took off from there. And it was, you know, we sold it pretty early, and so we did okay, but it wasn't the boom period of the internet. So,
yeah.
But it was fun to have that kind of startup experience.
So, I mean, from the customer standpoint back then, I mean, a lot of companies really weren't getting into technology and email and stuff, and so they didn't understand what they needed. Were you doing a lot of sales to them to convince them they needed email, or were you seeing people actually already starting to move that direction?
Yeah, I mean, there were people in the early 90s, I think email was taking off in a big way, but it was primarily still internal email.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's lots of organizations in the IT space were kind of local area networking kind of in the very late 80s and early 90s was kind of taking off. And so people would wire up Ethernet or Token Ring back then.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of getting on email systems. It's funny, you know, most of the email systems back then don't even exist today. So I remember DaVinci systems and on technology, I can't even remember the name of the email system that we used. I think MS Mail didn't come around for a while.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, there's various Lotus, Derivians, and couple IBM solutions. And so, you know, a lot of people were getting internal email going because they were seeing some of the return on investment. And so it was an easy pitch to say, hey, cost X amount and you get users on it. And the internet was kind of just taking it to the next level. The problem on the internet back in the early 90s was there just wasn't enough people on the internet. And then all of a sudden it started to grow, and, you know, you had the AOLs of the world that were starting to pump people in there. And, you know, our pitch was mainly it was really easy to get people on there. And, you know, I think one of the things that it did teach me was, you know, if you're in a startup kind of world or you're in a, you know, you're growing your base, when the phone rings, you know, everyone picks it up, and you don't have a product support staff or you don't have a community evangelist or something like that. It's, you know, you've got three people, and whoever is nearest the phone is the one who gets to pick up the phone. And, you know, that taught me a little bit in terms of kind of the importance of how do you take care of your customers, and, you know, how do you not think it's someone else's job? And there were a bunch of kind of marketing skills and evangelism skills, and how do you sell a product and get people excited? And it was useful, because we had some success, but also there was a bunch of people that I kind of learned from. And, you know, there's still some core things that I kind of apply to my day-to-day job that I think came out of that.
Mm-hmm. How did you even get involved in that during your college days? I mean, it seems like you should have been spending all your time studying and partying or something. And
it was funny. When I went to college, I was fortunate in that my dorm was, I think, the only dorm in the entire campus that was wired for internet. And it wasn't kind of internet, it was Ethernet. I think you had internet access, but it was, you know, for the most part, it was, you could use the Telnet protocol to get to, we just switched from VAXs to DEC alphas. I don't think they were the pre-alphas, they were MIPS chips. You know, and so, you know, you could basically Telnet in, and you could use, I remember using Pine as my email system. And it was, you know, pretty rudimentary stuff, but it was pretty cool. And, you know, being able to read a book on the internet and, you know, the browser didn't exist. Gopher was about the most advanced protocol out there. It was the coolest thing in the world. You know, no one today even remembers what the heck Gopher was. Yeah. But, you know, it was kind of early days. And so I'd started in college there. And then when I'd gone back home over the summer, I can't remember, it was my sophomore year. It was probably my sophomore year. I sort of said, hey, this internet thing's going to be big. And, you know, managed to convince a few people that it was. And that's kind of how it led to there. So I was kind of in the right place at the right time. If I'd been in a different school, if I'd been, frankly, in a different dorm in the same school, I might be teaching history. I don't know, that was kind of fortuitous.
Yeah. What other memories do you have from a technology standpoint of college and having that, you know, forming the foundation of what you're doing later on?
You know, when I went to college, for me, anyway, it was a fortunate time in that the internet was just sort of starting to appear. We just moved to C++ in the curriculum. I was like the first year that they'd actually taught C++. And it was kind of pseudo C++. It was mostly really C, and, you know, there were still some.
C++ is just pseudo C anyway. It's like,
but I remember I had a professor my first year, and he was a great professor. And, really started pushing object-oriented concepts. And it was way early in object-oriented concepts. And so, small talk guys would tell you that it was way late. But, you know, for most people in the industry, C++ was, kind of syntactic sugar on top of C, and you still wrote in a very procedural way. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate to have a couple of classes where it was deeply object-oriented hierarchy. And, really learning the object-oriented part of C++ as opposed to simply,
trying to get people to forget their C roots and start from C++ from scratch almost.
And really, you know, take a very kind of object-oriented approach from the get-go. And so instead of, you know, here's a for loop and here's an if statement, and then, you know, week 20 is when you actually learn what an object is. You know, I think we kind of learned like what an object was on, you know, week 2. And you know, it's kind of funny, when I took my job interview at Microsoft as an intern, the questions I was asked, the funny thing was they had nothing to do with object-oriented. And so, you know, if they'd asked me, you know, something along those lines, I'd probably be in better shape. And he was asking me, you know, low-level memory allocation stuff. And I knew enough to get the job. But it definitely pushed me. And then I'd use syntax on the board, and he'd go like, what the heck is the syntax? Is it really compiled? And I'd say, yeah, and explain it to him. And it was kind of I remember one of these interviews where I think I learned some stuff and he learned some stuff, and we decided, hey, maybe we could work together over the summer or something. So I was fortunate on the whole object-oriented aspect, and kind of higher level languages. You know, if I'd graduated 3 or 4 years earlier, you know, I'd probably be doing lots of, you know, coursework in assembly and or Pascal or Fortran or other languages. And it was, you know, kind of the internet was getting big just as I was kind of graduating, it was big. But kind of from freshman year to senior year was when it went from kind of email. I think sophomore year was when, you know, this thing called Mosaic came out, you know, Netscape and the browser started to take off. And by the time I graduated, it was obviously kind of full blown, and you know, Java had appeared and other things.
This is like 95, 96?
Yeah. So it was an exciting, you know, the thing I like about the computer industry is every year is an exciting year, pretty much. And so, you know, since then it's not been super dull. We often think, you know, oh, the industry's moving so fast, and, you know, we have smartphones and we have tablets and we have cloud and we have this and that. And, you know, that's part of the reason why I really like the industry I'm in is, you know, if you look back over the last 15 years, there's almost always been one of those periods where, you know, there's nothing bigger than the internet, and now we just take it for granted. Yeah.
Or Pong.
Exactly. Or Palm, if you remember Palm when. Yeah. So it's been fun. Yeah.
So when you're in college and starting to think about your career after college, was Microsoft the only company you thought of, or what were some of the thoughts you had?
I was actually serious about not doing not doing kind of a computer science bent, and so I was doing Palestine history, and but I ended up doing kind of like summer internships and working in the tech business, and so kind of I did this startup, and I did I kind of wrote a database, kind of a CRM system, I guess. It was all in Fox Pro, and you know, started off innocuously, but it was kind of a pretty in-depth CRM system and sales order system at the end. And I didn't know anything about databases at the time, or not much. You know, but had fun with that. And then I did kind of this email startup. And then my junior year, I interviewed with Microsoft as an internship. And
So back in the junior year, you were involved in...
Yeah, and so kind of my somewhere between my junior and senior years, where I was still trying to decide, yeah, I think I'm going to do computer science. And then I came out to Microsoft and just had a blast for the summer and sort of said, this is where I want to go. And you know, that was kind of, my parents kind of knew, my mom was hoping I'd live on the East Coast near where she lives, and, you know, came back and said, well, there's lots of good stuff around here. And I said, oh, Mom, this is my dream job. And she still tells me that. And, you know, and that was kind of, I worked on the NT team back then. And, you know, it was fun, you know, building an operating system. And mm-hmm. I was kind of hooked on doing system level stuff from that point on.
Was there anything about the Microsoft culture that kind of dragged you in and kind of really grabbed you from that standpoint?
You know, the fun thing about Microsoft is, you know, there's kind of your day job, and then you can figure out how far beyond your day job do you want to go. And so I was kind of a crazy intern that would, I usually went to home like 4 or 5 a.m. every morning and, you know, be back at 9:30 or 10 or something. And I think they were worried about me. Because they were like, you know, you can go home and sleep. But yeah, I was having fun. It was like, hey, I'm hacking on NT, you know, and so they'd give me a job and they'd say, hey, this could take a month. And I'd be like, hey, let me see if I can get it done in 2 days. And, you know, at some point towards the end, they're like, hey, you know, you're pretty good. And yeah, but I was just, for me, it was, they were like, oh, you're working so hard. And I was like, oh, you know, I'm having fun. This is cool. And so, you know, that for me was just the culture of being able to kind of pick stuff up and really run with it and be creative and get a lot of stuff done. And being around smart people, you know, it was cool to, you know, I still remember being in the elevator once and Dave Cutler walked in or something and he scowled at me or something. And, you know,
he scowls at everybody.
Yeah, he scowls at everyone. But, you know, that was cool. You know, it was just sort of, there was an energy there that was fun. And I said, hey, I want to be part of it.
Yeah. You know what components on NT you're working on?
Yeah. I was working on a technology that, in hindsight, was completely useless. But but it was fun. It was called Ole Structured Storage.
Oh, yeah.
And so we were working on kind of optimizing the disk layout so that when you downloaded, like, Word documents over the internet, the idea was the app could basically launch the document before before the full download had happened. And so we kind of, you know, for people that go way back when in COM know that there's this thing called structured storage, and it's kind of a file system within a file system, and it has its own kind of semi-goofy semantics. And I basically had to kind of reverse engineer how that worked because there weren't a ton of specs around. And it was kind of, could you watch an app as it read a document? And then could you basically lay out the bytes on disk so that you didn't have to block, was the idea. And I don't know if anyone ever used it, but it was fun, and it was, you know, it was pretty low level, and you know, it gave me an opportunity to kind of you know, work on something that, you know, would ultimately ship to hundreds of millions of people. And I think it's probably still in Windows today. I don't think they've taken it out. And so it's...
There's some code floating around there someplace.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. In hindsight, I think I have some floppy disk. Probably it still has my intern project on it that was all the test drivers for the thing. And it would be fun to actually find out whether that DLL is either still in Windows or the SDK or wherever the heck it is. I can't remember the DLL name. But it was, you know, but it was fun to, you know, to be part of the you know, see the nightly builds come out and be part of the ship process. And we shipped about 2 weeks before my internship ended. And so that was, you know, it was just fun to kind of see the final ship cycle, and kind of the energy around it was really nice.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, the ship cycle, normally they call it a death march, which doesn't quite add to that the whole fun aspect of it. As an intern, it's not quite the same death march as if you have to be working there year after year doing that same sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, it used to be like, yeah, people would have sleeping bags on their door, and you know, it's shifted a little bit. I think, you know, the funny thing is once everyone has had DSL, the culture changed a little bit because you could go home.
Yeah.
Whereas when I was an intern, you know, if you went home, you know, you had to sleep or, you know, hang out with people. Whereas, you know, now you can do that and then go back and you know, dial in or not, you don't dial in anymore, but you kind of connect in. And so, yeah, so it was kind of a different in that, you know, you knew who was working because you could walk down the hall back then and you could get a dial up, but it was, you know, 9,600 baud and that was pretty painful. It was fun.
Okay. So you finish your internship that summer and you go back to college for your senior year. How did that experience change what you did at school, or was just, you know, you said to yourself, I'm going to go to Microsoft once I finish college?
I was pretty sure I was going to Microsoft. I had a really nice recruiter who had lots of fun with all his candidates and in a good way. And so I jokingly made him a reference every time I interviewed somewhere else. And so I totally freaked him out. And, you know, I wanted to see what else was out there. They'd call for references.
So you were interviewing at other companies. This Microsoft recruiter was your reference on the list.
Yeah. It was actually a very good way to get some good offers from Microsoft. And, you know, you'd call me up. Guthrie, what are you doing? What are you doing? Don't talk to them. You know, just mainly because I was curious to see the industry. And I'd never been to Silicon Valley, so I went out once or twice and kind of to San Jose and you know, talked to a few companies there. But I was 99.9% sure I wanted to come back. In the end, you know, had a couple offers from Microsoft and kind of picked the group I wanted to be in.
Mm-hmm. So what was the interview cycle like when you came back? Since you were an intern already, you kind of knew the culture of Microsoft, the processes. Did you have that same very structured interview cycle that most Microsoft candidates have?
It was a little different. I actually, partly because I think they were freaked out that I kept talking to other companies, I actually kind of interviewed with like four teams and kind of ended up having kind of four different kind of offers. And so they were trying to figure out, hey, what do you want to do and where do you want to be? And so it kind of ranged all over the place. Ironically, Visual Studio was one of them that I turned down. And Windows was one on NT back then. And then Office was another. And then there was kind of this fourth group that was this tiny group, and they were building an internet web server. And frankly, I'd never heard of them before. And this was like before we had a web server.
Yeah.
But it was led by a guy named Jay Allard, who kind of went on to do the Xbox and some other stuff. And he was kind of a wild and crazy guy in a fun way. And so I kind of interviewed with him, not thinking I'd ever in a million years go off. I just kind of liked the vibe and the energy. I remember he interviewed me and I think he was limping down the hallway and I said, oh, did you hurt your foot? And he said, I think I broke it. I sprained it really bad, and you know, he didn't have a cast or anything. And I said, well, you thought about doing it.
He's like, he's biting on a bullet, right?
Yeah. I said, oh, okay. You know, how did you do it? And he's like, oh, I was out late last night slam dancing. And I was like, oh, cool. Okay. I'd never actually known anyone that had done slam dancing. And so we ended up talking, and I think it was like midnight by the time we were done with the interview, and we just kind of clicked. And so I ended up, you know, saying, oh, yeah, I'll do this internet thing. And it was fun because it was just a different kind of pace that we ran at. You know, we typically, I don't think I've ever worked harder over a year long period. We worked hard. You know, it was kind of, I think we did mostly nightly builds would come out at 10 o'clock at night and you'd basically pick them up and, you know, pretty much everyone would stick around. Because again, you couldn't really work from home. It was a pretty weak dial-up connection.
Mm-hmm.
Typically the whole team would be there until 2 or 3 in the morning, and then we'd start war room triage at 9 a.m., and, you know, you'd do that for about a year, day in and day out, 7 days a week.
Kind of drains you after a while, doesn't it?
It drains you after a while. I mean, it was, after we shipped, I mean, I remember I was, I was put in charge of internet, of stress and performance, or not performance, stress, because we basically, I think our reliability, back then we said, oh, we need to survive 3 days. And I think at the time that I got put in charge of it, we survived about 2 minutes before the whole server would fall over. And this is, you know, back in the days when the web server went down, it didn't just bounce back up because we had a worker process model. It went down and, you know, a user had to reboot the machine or at the very least restart the Windows service. And so it was pretty bad when it went down. And, yeah, and so I got, you know, my claim to fame was, you know, like we were shipping in October, November, I think November, and, you know, come end of August, early September, they said, you're in charge, Scott, go fix it. And
you said thanks.
I said thanks. And, you know, I was thankfully dumb enough, I didn't know what I was getting into. And, you know, and that was, you know, it was one of those, you know, pretty much lived in the office and was known for sleeping under my desk for about 2 months. And, you know, and we got to the point where I think the final build survived 3 days. And I had this pager that would go off anytime a machine crashed in any of our labs. And you know, you'd get home and be exhausted, you'd climb into bed, and the pager would go off, and you'd, you know, you'd climb back in and drive to work or debug it, and like I infamously showed up at a developer's door at 6 a.m. with donuts to bring him into the office to debug a nasty stress crash. And anyway, in the end, it worked, and the last 3 days were probably the most stressful of my day. I remember going to some movie and just sitting there for like the same movie for 3 hours or three times because I was so zoned out, and I just basically had this pager in my lap, and so the whole movie I'm just watching it and you know, waiting for it to go off to say that,
you know, would.
I'd screwed up the entire release and that, you know, the whole company was going to kill me. And and then finally the 72-hour mark kicked over and I was like, okay, now I can sleep. But so that was my first hardcore ship cycle, but it was fun, you know. It was it was fun in hindsight. But I hope I don't have to do too many of those.
It makes a good story to talk about,
it
right?
It makes a good story. I mean, I've had a few others since then in terms of last year's Windows Phone 7 release for Mix was probably an equally stressful glide path in. But that one probably was my first one, was definitely the pinnacle in terms of stress.
So what were some of the early technology you worked on here at Microsoft? So you got IIS or...
It was IIS, you know, ASP, you know, the classic ASP, we call it now. You know, back then it was, you know, even in college, you know, I'd done some like senior project where we'd done something with HTML, but it was still really new. I mean, it's kind of, we take all this stuff for granted, but this was like, you know, pre-JavaScript days, pre-CSS. I don't even know what was HTML1 or HTML2 or, I mean, I don't even know we had a version number back then. It was so new, HTML1.1. You know, HTTP1.1, I think, as a spec was just forming. Keep Alives were still in the future from a protocol perspective. And so, you know, it was still really early. And so I remember, you know, as we were working on kind of classic ASP, you know, it was pretty rudimentary in pretty early days. And, but it was fun. You know, it was, well, there were no dev tools. It was Notepad. I mean, I literally... You know, I was famous in my early days for doing all my demos with Notepad. And it was probably because there really wasn't anything else out there. This was pre-Visual InterDev. This was pre-Visual Studio. It didn't even exist back then as a suite. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, they were fun days in the sense of, you know, you could just sort of tell we were on the cusp of something big. And it was, again, I was lucky in my career to be in that place. You know, I could have been working on something else that was more mature, and maybe there weren't those opportunities. And, you know, and as we shipped that first release, kind of Jay came into my office and was like, hey, you look really tired. I was like, oh, I'm really tired. He said, well, why don't you guys, you know, my boss, Mark Anders and I, he said, you know, go figure out kind of what we should do for programming and programming model stuff for the web kind of next. And, you know, go take a couple of weeks and figure it out and, you know, give you a time to get some sleep and catch up on stuff. And so, you know, Mark and I, you know, it was supposed to be kind of, I think, a stretch, you know, laid back assignment, started looking at programming model stuff and, you know, looked a lot at, you know, talked to a lot of people that were using ASP and asking, what do you like and what don't you like? And, you know, at the time back then, you know, we didn't have any notion of process models. So like when your app crashed, you brought down the server. We didn't have any compiled code really. It was all interpreted script, and the script engines were not very fast. And, you know, when you loaded a component or a DLL or a class that was compiled, it was with COM using automation. And so there were all these threading issues around performance. And whenever you loaded any component, it locked the DLL on disk. And so if you ever made a change to it, you had to actually recycle the server every time. And configuration was always in the metabase, which is this wonderful, binary blob of crap. We talked to everyone, and they'd ask all these things, and they'd say, "Well, my code looks like spaghetti. It's sort of write once, read never." It was kind of a common term we heard, and it was difficult to develop, and the tools didn't work well, and configuration was a nightmare, and it didn't scale, and there were performance problems. And you know, what we thought was going to take a couple of weeks to come up with, like, hey, let's add these four features to classic ASP, you know, ended up kind of us stepping back saying, like, wow, you know, this thing we're so proud of that we just shipped has a lot of problems. And we sort of recommended, like, hey, maybe we should do a deeper look at kind of our web programming model end-to-end and do something that's going to be more than 4 weeks of work. And it turned out to be .NET. We started from that angle, to looking at it from the web perspective. In parallel, there was another team that was called the Lightning team, and they were looking at building a managed runtime that had garbage collection and kind of, you know, this intermediate language IL format and a C++ compiler called Simple Managed C. And they were kind of started around the same time that we were looking at the website stuff. Our web stuff was originally going to be written in C++, Java, and JavaScript. We started thinking about that. I wrote kind of the original prototypes for ASP.NET in C++ and Java and JavaScript, ironically. And then about that time, we kind of bumped into this team called the Lightning team. And I think there were six of them, and there were like four of us or three of us at this point. And we sort of said, hey, we should get together and, you know, almost double our resources. And we did, and that team became the CLR team, and the team that kind of I was working on became ASP.NET. And so
essentially, what we have now is the inklings, the beginnings of the .NET framework, and what became .NET for the rest of the company.
Yeah, it's a lot of people kind of think it, you know, oh, it must have been this giant strategy, and you know, Bill came down from the mountain and said, "You will go build .NET." And to be honest with you, it was a couple groups. I mean, it wasn't just us. The tools teams got involved in a language and a compiler perspective. But it was kind of a bunch of people around the company kind of teasing apart, like, hey, we need an easier way to do development. We need something that's object-oriented from the get-go, something unlike COM that was a little bit easier and could kind of support kind of frameworks, if you will, as opposed to simply components. And it kind of grew from there, kind of more scenario based. And, you know, one of the common things for all these teams were, we were small enough to fail. You know, people, you know, a number of people had told me, like, you're insane to think that you can actually make garbage collection on a server work. Like, that is just a proven fact. It will never work. You're throwing away your career. People insisted on this, but they're like, hey, there's only three of you. So if it fails, it doesn't really matter. It's not going to, you know, kill the company, so you know, go waste your life and your time and go try to make that work. We were either really smart or really dumb or somewhere in between, and it didn't really matter whether we, you know, screwed up colossally or whether we pulled it off. And you know, we just kind of kept working at it and kind of evolved it from there.
The key thing there is that there was a lot of synergy going on. I mean, like you were saying, different parts of the company were trying to find this object-oriented programming direction they can move into. And I remember seeing a bunch of different groups were planning the next version of their technology, you know, GDI Plus. Mm-hmm. You know, ASP.NET was planning on their next version. Other groups were planning on their next version. And with everyone looking at it at the same time, kind of having the cards up in the air, that gave you a chance to kind of see what everyone else is needing and doing and pull everything together.
Yeah, and we were lucky in the sense of we always had a prototype. That was something that from the very beginning, like Mark and I spent about 2 weeks whiteboarding ideas, And then at some point, you know, we said, look, we need to get write some code and actually get something up and running. We won't ship it, but let's just get a code base started so that we can really start trying these things out. And so I kind of wrote the, I think it was over New Year's, between 97 and 98, kind of the original ASP.NET prototype. We called it XSP, XS. And people would say, oh, what does the X stand for? And you're like, oh, it's XML something. And XML back then was really cool. And so, you know, there's XSLT and XML. And so we're like, XSP, that's our name. But we always had something you could write code against. And so we'd basically build these apps and then kind of dissect it and step back and say, oh, you know, what are the commonalities, lines of code, concept count, et cetera, go back and iterate the prototype. And so, you know, even before we got to meet the team that became the CLR or the team that became C Sharp or the team that became VB.NET, we were able to kind of always have some code that worked. And it might be Notepad and it might be with JavaScript or it might be with Java, but we could kind of show the concept. And it made it real, and it made us kind of be able to kind of incrementally refine it. And then as kind of more teams came on board, it kind of got more real, and we could say, oh, we need a data stack. Oh, let's go talk to the data team. We need an XML stack. Let's go talk to the XML team. You know, we need, you know, a new language. Let's go talk to the team that became C Sharp and Anders. And, you know, that helped a lot in terms of just iterating.
Now, back in those days, too, there was the big debate. Managed code, unmanaged code. Mm-hmm. And you guys were taking the managed code bet. What do you think about those times?
You know, it's funny, you know, a lot of the things that we debated back then that people just said, oh, you'll never make work, you know, was this whole notion of using managed code on the server. Ironically, you know, it's the debates we sometimes still have about managed code on the client with large ISPs, but you know, back then, everyone said, oh, you know, garbage collection might make sense on the client, but never makes sense on the server. You know, Java had not really succeeded on the server at that point. It was, you know, primarily an applet technology. And even the original CLR design pretty much focused almost entirely on client-side scenarios. It wasn't until we kind of came along on the server side that they said, oh, maybe there's more than applets. And over time, by the time we shipped, we actually said, oh, our primary scenario is server. But I think one of the things that we did well from a principal perspective is we sort of said, look, the majority of the code running on the server is going to end up being customer code and developer code. And so if we can't make .NET scale and work well for the small amount of stuff that's on our call stack, we're never going to get that big customer app to actually work well. And so we kind of made a bet from the beginning that we were going to write most of ASP.NET in managed code. And so our worker process, our ISAPI integration, there were large subsystems that we still wrote in native. But we made a big bet to say, like, hey, we're going to have a page object, and it's going to be written in managed code. And we're going to have a parser, and it's going to be written in managed code. And the benefit of that was the productivity wins it gave us. And then the other big benefit was around, you know, in the early days, we could start with Hello World to do perf benchmarking. And because there was enough .NET code on the call stack, even Hello World was actually a really good benchmark. And you know, our original benchmark perf numbers when we started were abysmal. You know, 15 pages per second was probably a not unrealistic load on a high-performance server. And but we started early, and basically we worked with the CLR team and just kind of got it faster and faster. I think by the time we shipped, we were 10,000 pages per second or something for Hello World. And the benefit was that when you branched out from Hello World to something more advanced, it wasn't like we had a whole bunch of native code and then three lines of managed code on the call stack. And we had, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of lines of code on the call stack or had run through that path had a lot of managed code on the call stack. And that meant that when we actually brought more workloads on the server, we'd actually done a heck of a lot of performance tuning already. And I think that was a key reason why we actually made .NET work so well on the server.
Mm-hmm. And then .NET just kept on evolving, adding more technologies to it, release after release after release coming out. Then we even had Silverlight, which mm-hmm. was another .NET technology. How exactly did that come about?
Yeah, well, it's you know, .NET is going to be 11 years old in July of this year. And so it's you know, since we first started talking about it publicly, and it's probably another two 2 years before that that we actually been working on. So it's been around for a while. I think one of the things that's been nice is how it's kind of adapted and how we can kind of integrate it in lots of different scenarios, whether it's server to client to mobile to cloud, et cetera. You know, Silverlight started out from kind of in 2006, late 2005, 2006, where, you know, we're trying to figure out, like, what is the next generation client look like from a development platform perspective? And, you know, at that point, I think one of the things that we'd realized that probably in hindsight, I think we could have done better with .NET if we'd started from the beginning was, you know, deployment size and client side kind of profile capabilities. You know, .NET by that time in 2005, 2006, you know, was 20 megs, 30 megs in size. It, you know, wrote to the registry and had a bunch of kind of operating system level and integration dependencies that required, you know, an install time that was, you know, longer than 20 seconds. And so we were like, oh, you know, the .NET framework client profile or, you know, client redist was probably too big to do web development with. But we still really like the CLR
on, the client.
On the client, yeah. And so we do desktop apps, but if we wanted to basically run stuff inside a browser and or support kind of cross-platform, we had to do work. And so what we did with Silverlight was
this basically mean taking over the role that ActiveX had on client. So you want to take and have something was small enough you could download from a web page and have functionality beyond what HTML can handle within the browser itself.
Yeah, and be able to go after scenarios kind of slightly different than desktop apps, be able to go do media, to be able to do, you know, forms over data, line of business scenarios, how to do interactive UI scenarios. And, you know, what we ended up doing with Silverlight was to say, hey, let's take the CLR code base, let's take our .NET code base, let's trim it down to be as tight and small as possible and kind of grow it up from there. And that's kind of how Silverlight kind of evolved to. And obviously today we use Silverlight within the browser. And, you know, for a lot of scenarios, you know, a lot of line of business and enterprise apps use it. Certainly for media inside the browser, you know, companies like Netflix and the Olympics use it very heavily for streaming. And then, you know, more recently we've evolved Silverlight to run on other devices and form factors as well. And so, you know, most notably Windows Phone.
Now, recently, you actually moved to kind of a new role inside of Microsoft. Where you were focused on ASP.NET and Silverlight and other technologies in that pillar. What are you doing now exactly?
Yeah, I've been kind of moved to the cloud. No, you know, a lot of people often ask, like, what do I do, even historically, and they often think, like, oh, you do everything. So I actually don't do everything. You know, historically.
I haven't seen you working in the kitchen yet, so.
Yeah, well, it depends on the time. No, you know, I've kind of focused a lot on the last couple of years on kind of core.NET, so the CLR, the website on ASP.NET and IIS and our Visual Studio tools, and then on the client and mobile side. And so drove a lot of, you know, the Windows Phone development plans, and then obviously Silverlight and WPF for full desktop. Recently kind of shifted focus slightly, and I basically spent a lot of time, I'm spending most of my time now working on cloud with Azure, and I also still drive all the web work that we do. So ASP.NET is still very much part of my team, but also kind of I'm focusing a lot on kind of cloud with Azure and a lot of our middle tier technologies. So things like WCF, Workflow, AppFabric, BizTalk, and others that kind of complement and are part of that overall cloud story. Mm-hmm. My CLR team and the Silverlight WPF team. Are still under the same leaders that used to work for me, now I kind of collaborate with them as opposed to directly manage them, and I've kind of taken on kind of a larger team focused more now on the cloud side, and so that's where I'm spending most of my time. But I'm still very, very much involved in .NET. A lot of people ask me, "Oh, are you leaving .NET or Visual Studio?" No, I'm not leaving .NET. Ironically, a lot of the pieces on the server side that I didn't used to own, I now do own, and so I've probably got as many technologies and APIs and .NET as I used to. It's just kind of a shifted focus a little bit more to focus on cloud, middle tier, and web and server, as opposed to kind of mobile and client as much as I used to in the past. Mm-hmm. So I'm having fun with it because it's kind of a completely new space. Same space, but very new in terms of capability. And I do think for a .NET developer, that's a big area that there's huge opportunities where if we can invest in providing kind of a world-class cloud environment, that I think, you know, some of the .NET developers, regardless if you're coming from an ASP.NET background or you're a .NET client developer using WPF or Silverlight and you want to have a backend that you talk to, you know, either one of those things, I think the Azure work we're doing is going to be really important.
Mm-hmm. I mean, kind of the way I see it is that, you know, with the .NET technologies or almost any operating system technology, when you spend a lot of time working on some component to make it really good, you suddenly start noticing some of the valleys that aren't quite up to that same level, and you say, okay, this is working, let's go fix that guy now.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, you know, this cloud concept isn't really a new concept. We're just approaching it a new way to actually make it a first-class citizen within the programming models. People actually utilize it as if they were using a regular computer.
Yeah, I mean, I think the cloud is definitely, from a concept perspective, you know, we've had web hosting with ASP.NET and IIS for a long time. You know, going back even further in the client-server days, or frankly, even in the mainframe days, you know, it's kind of embarrassing how much stuff from the 1970s or even the 1960s, you know, System 360, you know, back in, I don't even know what year that is, back in the, you know, the old IBM days, you know, they had a lot of concepts that cloud computing is just getting now. And so, you know, I've talked to people and they'll be like, yeah, that's been around for 30 years.
Yeah.
But most developers that I work with or historically worked with, and, you know, frankly, even in the Java space and the LAMP space, you know, we're not familiar with some of these concepts.
Well, there is COBOL.NET, right? You
know, there is COBOL.NET, yeah. It's less the language. It's less the language and more the sort of concept of, you know, is there an environment that you can run your code in that you can kind of never take down the service? Can you update the actual infrastructure that you're running on without ever taking it down? You know, can you scale across multiple data centers if need be? And just from a practical perspective, where people are like, yeah, I'm not going to build the next Facebook. I'm working on a line of business app, or I'm working on a system for, you know, a small, medium business company. You know, think about how many times when you're working on an app that either you've been stymied in terms of what you can do because you don't have the budget to do it, or it's just a hassle to have to configure all those things. Like, hey, yeah, if there was a cache API I could take advantage of to make my app faster, hey, if it was a couple minutes of work to do, I'd do it. But I don't want to have to deploy a cache server. I don't want to have to buy another hardware, you know, server to do it. And so it's just not worth me doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what we're trying to do with the cloud is to say, hey, there's a programming model environment where you have a lot of these APIs that you can take advantage of, that will scale for you, that will actually manage for you. And, you know, some of them are free and some of them cost a little bit, but the actual cost to them from an operation perspective is a fraction of what it would be if you had to set up a server in your own environment. And more importantly, it's the type of thing that, hey, in less than 2 minutes, I can turn on that feature, write a couple lines of code and take advantage of it. And once you can start to do that and you build up enough of these sort of platform services, your toolbox as a developer is just so much more powerful. And, you know, when we started ASP.NET, we used to think about what are the UI controls on the toolbox that we fill up. And, you know, at some point you start to run out of ideas to put on that toolbox. I kind of view a little bit on the cloud side, the toolbox just got a lot richer. They're not UI components, but they're services you can take advantage of. And the toolbox of things that we're going to be able to offer, I think, to developers, in particular .NET developers with Azure, is going to be a really big one. And that's going to be exciting for any developer, whether you're working on a small project that only 10 other people are ever going to consume, or if you want to scale that and build, be the next Facebook or the next giant startup, you know, we think we're going to have a world-class solution for you.
So you predict a lot of change for Azure and cloud computing that we're going to see moving forward with .NET programmers?
Change might be the wrong word. I think there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of upside. You know, Azure today is a very solid foundation. And, you know, the whole kind of concepts in terms of kind of how it's structured and kind of the way we've built it, you know, we have 6 data centers deployed today with more coming. We pair the data centers so that you can, you know, switch in and out of data centers in case something goes wrong or there's a weather event or a, you know, this particular event in that particular region, you can switch to it dynamically. You know, a lot of the way we architect and run code inside Azure today is, really, really clever. You know, if you, for example, deploy an app and you say, I want to have three instances of a particular web role. So it's a web app with a database. You can say, I want to have three VMs of my web app. You know, we'll split it up across multiple power racks and racks within the data center. So even if you lose a network switch, or even if the power blows up on that rack or the CPU melts, it keeps running.
Yep.
So it's some pretty advanced stuff that, yeah, you could do that yourself in your own data center, but gosh, it'd be a lot of work. We just kind of do that for you today. And I think you're going to see, in the future, I'll be able to talk about, more services and capabilities that come online. And one of the things I like to focus on is just kind of, how do we kind of relentlessly drive the friction out of the system and get it so that it's just, wow, it's super clean and simple to take advantage of those new features and make it really easy to get started and kind of start with a low concept count and then kind of scale up as you need those capabilities.
Well, I mean, to me, it sounds like we have to expect out of Windows Azure and what you can do there the same level of great functionality we've seen out of .NET overall. I mean, you've constantly been changing your career, going from IaaS to ASP.NET to Silverlight, other aspects of the framework, and now Azure. So the cloud is the next big thing.
Hope so. Yeah, looking forward to it.
Now, before we close the show down, there are a certain set of questions that I try to ask all my guests, just kind of let the audience get a feel of who they are and they kind of compare one guest to next. But, you know, no pressure there. So you know, don't compare yourself to other guests. But the first question is there a particular book you'd like to recommend to our audience that they read? It doesn't have to be a computer book, but a book you think they should all read.
This one I've been struggling with for days preparing for this question. I read a lot, so I have lots and lots of books that I really like. And so it's hard for me to pick one.
No, a Spider-Man comic doesn't count.
Yeah, I just finished a really good Alexander Hamilton biography from Ron Chernoff. That's the last book I read, so I'm not sure it's like the absolute book you should go out and get, but I thought that was pretty good.
Were there any particular aspect? Anytime I read one of those history biography, things, there's some aspect I go, my God, that's kind of amazing. I didn't know that before.
I think for Hamilton, it's amazing is everything he did before the age of 40 is kind of like intimidating. just sort of seeing kind of, he's helped found a government and write the Constitution and, set up the financial system and the banking system and, all that stuff. But
before breakfast, too.
I'm a big history buff, so I've always enjoyed kind of throughout history hearing about different things.
Yeah, that's good. The second question, if you didn't work in the computer industry, where do you think you'd be working right now?
I'd like to be in, be a history professor or something.
Hence reading the history books.
Yeah, so that's why I read the books. And, someday maybe I'll quit my day gig and go back to school and try to get qualified for that. But that's always a fantasy of someday in the future. But the future might never come.
Someday in the future, you'll be talking about .NET as that history lesson that you've
been
teaching people.
Maybe. It's fun. I mean, I do enjoy going out and, talking to a live audience about programming stuff. If I couldn't do the programming stuff, then, maybe it would be something to do on history. Maybe just, high school teacher or something of history class.
What do you feel is the most important technology in today's world?
Oh, I think in the computer space, there's tons of interesting stuff that's going on, but it's almost too close to home. So if you name anything, people join. In the years ahead, I think there's going to be a ton of really interesting things that in the power management space. As you think about electricity and power management, and as we move to kind of carbon-based fuels to things, I think there's a ton of really interesting technology. So if someone was just starting out now, whereas 15 years ago or 10 years ago, I'd say an electrical engineering degree would probably not be an interesting thing. You know, in hindsight, I wish I'd actually had more of a background there so that I could actually do stuff there. And I think the biotechnology space as well will be interesting. But I think in the as we think about kind of a world where we're worried about global warming and we're worried about power and electrical management, I think that'll be kind of interesting to see kind of what we do there.
So this kind of leads into my next question is 25 years from now, what technology would you like to see available?
Oh, I think one of those, like Star Trek where you can just beam someone across. Like I'd love to be able to, do lunch in London or actually lunch in Paris and then, go to a play in London for the evening. That would be awfully nice 25 years from now. I'm not entirely sure where we're going to get there, but
if I could pick one
device, that would be it.
They have been doing some pretty amazing things with some of these nanoparticle technologies going on.
Yeah. Yes, that's you also watched that movie, The Fly, or something. You first, but but it would be nice to have that. But yeah, that would be. I mean, it's one of those things where, we touched on earlier in the show of like just how dynamic the industry is. There's a different set of competitors. There's a different set of, technology innovators pretty much every decade, and the people you assume are going to be the strongest one year turns out to completely implode 2 years from later. And people you've never even heard of come up from nowhere and, are the hot new company, 3 years from now. And I think, 25 years from now, boy, this industry is going to look different. I can't even fathom how it'll look. Just if you think back 25 years from now, 1985, I guess, God, it doesn't sound like that's scary. That's only 25 years. 1986, we didn't really have Windows. We didn't really have mice. We didn't have more than about 512K of addressable memory, if that.
CD players were not common at all.
DVDs didn't exist. Yeah. The internet was, only used by the Department of Defense and a few academic schools. I mean, it's amazing to think what's changed. And, the fact that our cell phones now have more compute power than the Apollo 11 spacecraft that went to the moon is kind of amazing. And so, 25 years from now, it's going to be exciting. And what I can get, I don't know what it'll be, but I can guarantee it'll be interesting.
Oh, looking back at 1985, maybe we will have transporters in 25
years. Yeah, maybe
years
we will. Yeah.
So now the last question I have is we want you to take and draw your favorite data diagram or computing type picture. No pressure again, but let's see your creative chops and make sure you sign it too.
Oh, yeah. Let's see. What to put? I'm going to do something slightly different, which is not a true data structure. Maybe we'll do a class hierarchy, and we'll do the control class. We'll implement whatever I control. Go from there in terms of getters and setters for different things. Then, away you go in terms of from there, whether it's server side or client side, you can add more. But I've always found, C# and object-oriented languages like that.
Good start to objects. I mean, it's like, gets and sets, setting it together. That's the basics of everything.
Yeah. And being able to kind of compose, how can you take lots of different capabilities or services, whether the UI like control, whether it's some of the service stuff that we'll do with Azure and on the server side and with ASP.NET in the future. How can you as a developer take advantage of those things? How can you create your own? How can you subclass them and evolve them? Hopefully that ultimately makes all of our lives as developers a lot easier and a lot more fun.
Make sure you sign it so we can store this posterity. Sell it on eBay or something, I think.
There you go.
Well, thanks, Scott, from the Technical Community Network for being our guest today. And we hope you've enjoyed this chance to look at the technology and the person behind the code.